This is Vermont Edition. I'm Jane Lindholm. More than half of Vermonters believe that their local communities are a place where people tend to have different values and a variety of different political views. That diversity of thought may be great for a robust and vibrant community, but it could also be a little bit isolating for some people if they feel their values don't align well with those of their neighbors. Those stats come from our recent survey conducted by Braun Research for Vermont PBS and VPR on rural life in Vermont. Almost half of the 800 respondents said they have no people, or just a few people, to rely on for help or support. And 5% of respondents say they feel isolated from others all the time. 11% feel isolated a lot of the time. Now, those numbers are small. Only 16% of Vermonters feeling isolated or lonely most of the time. But think about it. That's more than 60,000 people who feel that way, perhaps right now. All this week, we're looking at issues that emerged from our rural life survey. And today we're going to talk about isolation and loneliness. Dan Smith is the president and CEO of the Vermont Community Foundation. Now, the Community Foundation is one of the sponsors of this project. But Dan thinks about these issues a lot. Welcome back to the program. Nice to have you.
It's a pleasure to be here, Jane.
Susan Randall is an investigator at VT Private Eye in Burlington. And she works closely with a wide range of attorneys on civil, state, and federal cases. She also used to work as a journalist, researcher, producer and public radio reporter, and she has a pulse on the sense of community and how isolation and loneliness play out in the criminal justice system. Susan Randall, it's a pleasure to have you with us today. I appreciate your perspective here.
Thank you so much. Great to be here.
Dan, I mentioned some of the statistics that came out of our rural life survey, and, you know, 16% of Vermonters who say they feel isolated always or most of the time. Only about 6% always, but still that's a significant chunk. And we also see questions in this survey about how connected people feel to their local communities through volunteering, either through civic town things, school things, religious organizations, or political organizations. But what do you think of the statistics and then what you see and feel on the ground?
Well, I think what's interesting about the survey and the responses is that there are a lot of different stories we tell about ourselves as a state, you know, whether it's regards to volunteerism, whether it's in regard to the connection that neighbors feel for each other, and the mutual support and trust and reciprocity, the complex reciprocity of neighbors who help neighbors. And but then when you dig into the data and you start to it's in the survey and you start to unpack it a little bit, you realize that the stories we tell ourselves really aren't matching up with some of the lived experience of Vermonters. And
in what way?
So it's not distinct, frankly, from what's going on nationally in terms of the overall decline of social capital and the connection that people feel across difference and across community, which has really been going on since the 1970s. But I think that the number of folks who described feeling isolated, you know, if the opposite of isolation is a sense of connection, it seems like the connection that we pride ourselves, the sense of common experience that informs a community and a strong community, is much more fragile than it's been historically. And, you know, so our work at the Community Foundation has really been informed by this sense that if the heart of a strong community is common experience, we understand now that in the 21st century, people simply don't experience the institutions that informed their lives the same way based on who their family is, where they live in the state, what their background is, what their education level, what their income is. and so, you know, because people aren't experiencing that way, you know, aren't experiencing the same things the same way. You don't have the same backbone of trust and reciprocity and common experience that allow people to have the confidence that there's, you know, the relational connection that builds a strong community.
Can I push you a little bit on that? Even though I said, look, it's a lot of people who are feeling isolated, who say they're feeling isolated. On the other hand, it's only 15 or 16%. In some ways, could we be seen as doing well in that connectivity and reaching out to one another and making sure we're checking on each other kind of side of things?
Yeah, I mean, there's always the tactical opportunity to walk out your front door, look left, look right, and knock on your neighbor's door. And
if you have neighbors.
If you have neighbors. Fair enough. There's always the geographic component. But I think what's interesting in the data is the relative difference in response rates across age, across education level, and across regions in Vermont. So you saw some different uptakes in terms of that question. You know, what struck me is the relative isolation of 18 to 44-year-olds, which we know from a bunch of different data sets is a population that actually tends to be leaving the state of Vermont. You know, it was 50% of 18 to 44-year-olds responded that they often or always feel isolated, while some of the other age groups, you know, it was closer to 30%. So, you know, while we...
Well, wait a minute. I'm looking at this here. So how often do you feel isolated from others? In the 18 to 44-year-old group, it's 7% feel isolated all the time, right? And 17% feel isolated often.
Well, sorry, I pulled it from before, Jane. So let me take a look at what you're
looking I'll let you use my cheat sheet.
Yeah.
Circled in orange. So but what you're saying is true in the sense that of the age groups, when you so, and also let me just stop it here for a moment to tell people, this is an open source poll. You can look at all of the results. Yeah. If you go to thislandvt.org, you can find them all. And one of the things that we've done is created subsets. So you can see the results, but then you can see them broken down in various ways. So you can see them broken down by region to see maybe how people feel isolated in different parts of the state. You can also see them by gender, by age, by education level. So Dan, you're looking at the age levels
here. So I'm looking at the age level. And my point was that if you layer in the sometimes response, you've got close to 50% of 18 to 44-year-olds saying they feel isolated sometimes, often, or always. Mm-hmm. And then across the 45 to 65-year-old, it's closer to 30%. Across over 65, it's closer to 30%. So we hear from employers in Vermont that workforce is a challenge. We know that throughout the course of youth development, we have challenges with young people showing up to kindergarten ready to learn. We have challenges with people advancing through the K-12 system based on socioeconomic background or regionality. We have challenges with college continuation. And then we have this challenge that people, once they come out of school and are engaged in community, they're still, and they may be working, but they're still feeling isolated. You know, that should be a long-term course cause of concern for us relative to the story we tell about Vermont being a place to live, work, and raise your family.
Yeah, and I wonder, and we don't get into this in the poll, but I wonder too if you're in that 18 to 44-year-old group, if perhaps you have some more agency in whether you're moving into or out of the state or into and out of different regions within the state, how that contributes. And that's not reflected in the data, but that's also an interesting point. And Susan, how do you come in on this? Where do you see just this broad picture of questions about loneliness and isolation in Vermont, which we know is a rural state and a small state, and in some ways very homogeneous, in other ways very diverse, depending on which sort of statistics that you're looking at. But how do you see it?
I mean, I see that people are feeling incredibly marginalized, and I see a lot of people who, different than, you know, if you're in New York City or you're in the Bronx and you're low income, and you're uneducated and you're feeling marginalized, you can jump on the 6 train and you can go downtown. I think what happens in Vermont, and I do see sort of a certain filter. I work on criminal defense cases, indigent clients, both on federal and state cases. And so a lot of the people that I see are people in poverty who feel marginalized, that don't feel like they're part of the economy. A lot of crime is basically people not being able to find their way in the mainstream legitimate economy, and so they're doing other things to get around that. So a lot of what I run into is that I get to the end of the dirt road and I'm walking in and out of houses that, unless you had a reason to go into that house, you would never knock on the door. So, you know, there's dogs tied to stakes in the front yard. There's broken down vehicles. There's a lot of trailers with no running water. And what's been stunning to me is we are watching this gap widen between the haves and have-nots at such an exorbitant level that once people are marginalized, it's really, really difficult for them to get back in. And, you know, something as basic as having teeth. This has been something that I have been stunned. I have days in certain pockets of Vermont where I interview 30 people and I might see three teeth. And those three teeth are rotting. So for that person to then try to apply for a job, for that person to walk in the door and fill out an application, they don't have a computer at their house. Everything's online. So the technology gap is huge. You know, and I think what happens is people need to feel needed. You know, the way you get self-esteem is you do esteemable things. And so what ends up happening is that people start to see themselves as disposable. They start to see themselves as not really necessary to the economy. And when that starts to happen, you know, that's when somebody sticks a needle in their arm because they just want to check out. They don't want to feel the pain. They don't want to feel marginalized. So, you know, and that's not to say everybody that's living at the end of the dirt road is that's their reality. I'm saying I see a certain section of the population that, and it's deeply disturbing to me, you know, even just dropping off subpoenas sometimes, I kind of get in my car and I'm silently sort of driving home through the rain like, wow, this is America. This is where we are.
This is Vermont.
Yeah, this is Vermont. And, you know, I think it is. I do work in New York City and in the Bronx and in Brooklyn as well and in upstate New York. And what's I think scarier about rural poverty is that if you're really out there, you don't, first of all, you don't have any necessarily have any examples of people that are in the game, that are getting up and, you know, applying for that job or applying to that school. And so, you know, I think that I think one of the things that we as a community in Vermont could really make an effort is when kids are in school, whatever you can do to kind of mix up the classes and have kids in carpools together. And I know schools make a lot of efforts to do these kind of things, but I think it makes a huge difference because how people see themselves is then how they see the trajectory of their life and being a part of. I think most crime in Vermont is just people not feeling a part of.
Reggie wrote in to say, my last job was remote, which in a rural setting can be isolating, and says when national trends indicate a third of workers will be able to work at home within the next 5 years, why hasn't Vermont made more of an effort to create co-work spaces so we workers don't feel so isolated? Similarly, kind of related, Mark tweets in to say, I feel incredibly isolated. I work from my home in Westford. I can go an entire day without seeing anyone. If not for my wife and pets, I would feel incredibly lonely. I try to get out on my lunch break, but there's nowhere around here that actually has people. So again, share your thoughts. Different thoughts here, but all connected from Dan and Susan and from Reggie and from George. Dan, you know, you were talking about some of the things like the education gap and the income gap, and Susan sees that really starkly in her daily job, and that's sort of what you were talking about from the bigger perspective as well.
Yeah, I mean, our role as philanthropy, as a philanthropy in the state, is to think about some of the systems that drive the lived experience that Susan's coming across in the communities that she's working in. And, you know, we do see a structural gap that exists in people's the opportunities that are available to people and as they think about what their future looks like. And that, and so we spend a lot of time trying to think about the tools and tactics that will help communities address that and rebuild the common experience and the sense of connection and mutuality that should exist in a healthy community. And that is things like access to early childhood care and education. It's the resources that support youth and families during their development. It's access to college and continuation and career training, the skills that allow somebody to be economically secure enough to think about what they can give to their neighbor in terms of mutual support and lending a hand as opposed to thinking about and being in a position where you're trying to hold or retain things relative to what's going on in the world around you and you're feeling insecure. And so, but the fourth piece is something that actually just came up around the co-working and places of intersection. We have seen an uptick in our grant making and the support of funders for places and co-working spaces and things like that as a tool for bringing people together in place and retaining and rebuilding a social connection in a time when the workforce is moving away. But you have to have the skills to be able to access that remote workforce, which, you know, requires more and more people to say to realize when they get to the end of high school that they're not done yet with their education. And we in Vermont have always had a high high school graduation rate, but a relatively low college continuation rate. And so that was one of the other dividing lines in terms of people's response in the survey for how they felt about their quality of life in Vermont and a host of other things. So, you know, our hope is to be able to shine a bit of a light on some of the systems that drive this sort of the very distinct perceptions of community that were revealed in the survey.
You know, we're talking about some of the compounding factors, which can certainly be related to poverty, related to education level, related to your family structure. But Susan, you know, loneliness doesn't know economic bounds. There are a lot of people who feel isolated and or lonely who may have enough money to get by but are still feeling that lack of connection. I mean, do you see that? Certainly poverty can be an absolutely confounding factor. And we're going to talk a little bit about mental health and access to mental health care and how that can also contribute. But, I mean, you must see as well people with who you'd think have this perfect life but have this deep sense of loneliness.
Yeah. I mean, again, I think, you know, I mean, that sounds ridiculous, but I remember that whole Occupy Wall Street thing where it was like, yeah, it's really lonely. The one percenters are just as lonely as, you know, other people that are in isolation. And I think, you know, one of the things that I don't know, when we're talking about this, I was just flashing on, I used to live in the Mad River Valley, and I actually still deeply connected to Warren and Waitsfield and Facetown. And one of the things that I remember during Irene being completely flabbergasted by, in the face of this huge tragedy, everybody sort of cleaning out each other's basements and digging out of this mud and all these, you know, it was this generation, everybody from 5 years old to 75 years old, like teaming up together, almost like an old barn raising ethic. And I think the more things that we can kind of do like that as communities where it goes across all classes, it goes across all different kinds of backgrounds where there's this sort of collective effort. I mean, I see it, you know, in Chittenden County. I mean, I love people doing music nights in the old Grange halls where, you know, some 13-year-old can bring their guitar and play with some old hippie who's, you know, singing some old protest song. You know, it's kind of this great thing. And I think the more things that we can do that are like that, I find that there are a lot of elderly people. You know, I end up working on some elder abuse cases. And I feel like there's this missing piece, not just in Vermont, but nationally, where we have all these amazing octogenarians and, you know, people in their 70s, 80s, 90s who have all this time and wisdom and compassion that, and then you have this middle generation that's just completely maxed out and working so, so hard. And I've been wanting for years to sort of, how do we link up some of these older men and women with these younger generations to give, you know, the working middle-aged people a family when they don't have their parents or grandparents living right next door. There's sort of like this gap. And I think technology's really contributed to it as well. I think that older people, I mean, I even notice it when I'm interviewing people for work, this gap between the millennials and 50, 60-year-olds, where I think people that are in their 50s or 60s trying to come into a workplace also feel very lonely and isolated, and they feel stupid because they don't understand the technology. And I, you know, I think the more things that we can do that bring people together around this stuff. I mean, one thing I just wanted to share quickly was a few years ago, I was noticing coming in and out of jails, a lot of my clients really depressed around Thanksgiving and Christmas. And so we started this thing. My kids were really into it. It's the Hope Beneath the Tree, which was like, we would give, you know, we just sent out an email to our family and friends saying, hey, do you guys want to get matched up with any of these incarcerated parents' kids and be gift givers? And it went viral. It went insane. It was like within a couple of years, we had over 230 kids being matched up. And these were, you know, people from outside of Vermont, too. But what was amazing to me was that Vermonters were so generous, and they wanted to figure out how they could help. I mean, Vermonters are great at buying stuff. It was like retail therapy. You know, they're like, oh, we don't know how to solve mass incarceration, but we can definitely buy a pair of like Spider-Man sneakers for the 5-year-old whose dad is incarcerated. What it showed me was that people are so looking for a way to bridge the gap. And people, if you give them an opportunity and you say, let me send you, here's a 12-year-old's name, here's where she's living at the end of the dirt road, and just send her a book she likes to read.
They'll do it.
They not only do it, they email all their friends, and all their friends want to do it, and all their kids want to do it. So I think it's just a matter of having it in our minds that it's not that people want to be up in their ivory tower, you know, whether they have money or don't have money or whatever. I think it's just finding platforms where they feel needed, and they figuring out a way that they can connect.
We're talking today about isolation and loneliness and how to combat that, how to find more connectivity between and amongst ourselves, and how to make sure that we're having vibrant, resilient communities. We'd love your thoughts. You can call 1-800-639-2211 or post them on the Vermont Edition page at vpr.org. I'm Jane Lindholm, and this is Vermont Edition. Today's show is part of This Land, the changing story of rural Vermont. It's a collaboration between VPR and Vermont PBS. And for the complete data set of the Rural Life Survey, as well as other programming in the This Land project, you can go to thislandvt.org. We're talking with Dan Smith today, the president and CEO of the Vermont Community Foundation, and with Susan Randall, an investigator at VT Private Eye LLC in Burlington. And let's go to Caitlin, who's calling in from Grand Isle County. Hi, Caitlin. Go ahead.
Hi, thank you. I just wanted to note, even though it's sort of off subject, that survivors and or victims, whether they be female or male of domestic violence, should probably feel that they are invisible in a state with so many people and so much room to put them in. There are definitely people who fall through the cracks. Many people that I know personally have, without communities like Burlington, for example, they would be in worse situations. There are a lot of people who turn to drug addiction and alcoholism to deal with these sorts of issues, and without the sense of family or belonging, it just unfortunately gets worse, as you can imagine. So I just thought if you maybe could touch on that, that would be good for those out there who are, in that situation.
Caitlin, thanks. Caitlin bringing up this question of survivors of domestic violence who often can feel isolated, and certainly other factors that go into that as well. Susan, you have thoughts on that?
Yeah, I think that getting connected with a community of people that have compassion and understanding and a shared experience, I think it can be really, really difficult in a small community. And I think often for victims who have stood up and spoken out, it can be incredibly alienating in a small town or a small community. And I think it's important for us to increase awareness of, you know, victim advocacy and support groups. And in small towns, it's you know, it's tricky because everybody knows everybody. Sometimes that works great. You know, you get a tooth taken out and everybody brings you soup and your fridge is filled with, you know, soup. Sometimes, you know, you're involved in a really high profile legal case and you can feel totally ostracized. So I think it's a really, thank you, Caitlin. It's a great point. And I think having an awareness of people needing to stay connected, especially when they're brave enough to speak up and to get help.
Kristen writes in to say, I suffer from feelings of isolation for a variety of reasons. Some of it is just the rural setting, which I love. I actually enjoy being alone most of the time. At times when I do seek out some company, I find that most people are fiddling with their smartphones and not interacting with the people around them. I find being with people who are so engrossed in their phones only adds to my feelings of isolation. And David is calling in from Brattleboro. David, you have thoughts on isolation and loneliness?
And really, you know, such an important subject. I'm a psychotherapist, and I get to see that firsthand. But I'm also a founder of something called V-Bike, which is about rebooting the bike in Vermont and looking at how transportation and really the whole like structural and systemic effect of the automobile on our culture. It spreads us out. It gives us great power. But at the same time, there's a divergent kind of impact to the automobile, where it can connect us to people that are distant from us, but disconnects us from our local environment. Right? You can walk down the street, even in Brattleboro, and be lonely because people are in these isolated, you know, sensory and social and ecological deprivation chambers, literally not connecting with those in front of them, behind them, people walking the streets, or perhaps people riding bikes.
Yeah, David, I hear what you're saying, and it's interesting that both you and Kristen talk about technology, and technology which can, for some people, be such a benefit in connecting to one another, especially if you don't find a community that you feel connected to within the place where you live. You know, technology can actually bring people together, and cars certainly have that ability too, but then they also have this ability to separate us from one another, to make us not even talk to the people who are in the same room with us. And so that double-edged sword of technology being both beneficial and really detrimental to these feelings of connectedness is interesting. I want to bring another voice into the conversation. George Karabakakis is the CEO at Healthcare and Rehabilitation Services of Southeastern Vermont. That's the designated agency for Windham and Windsor counties. George, thank you for being with us. I know you're away from the state at a conference, so I appreciate you taking the time to talk with us today.
No, absolutely. I think this is a really, really important issue because I think it goes to the core of some of the challenges we face at our agency, at HCRS, but I think all community mental health, actually it's really our community, but certainly at our community mental health centers, which are the safety net for so many, we see this issue of social isolation and loneliness impacting people in so many ways. I mean, there's a, and I do want to say there's a lot of research that's been out there that shows that social isolation and loneliness increase the risk of disease, the likelihood of premature death by, I believe, 45%, depression, suicide, and certainly for older Vermonters, cognitive decline. I think all of these issues are impacted. And aside from that, I think it's one of the greatest obstacles to health and wellness. So I think it's a really significant issue that we're all facing.
George, one of the things that came up in the poll was access to healthcare, and that wasn't broken down by what type of healthcare you're trying to access necessarily, whether it's emergency care, preventive care, mental health care, all of the sort of healthcare needs that we all have. But, you know, we do talk in this state a lot about the difficulties accessing particularly mental health care, and particularly in rural parts of the state where there are often fewer providers, certainly fewer psychiatrists, especially in many parts of the state, who can prescribe medicine. And I'm wondering how you see that as contributing to potential isolation and loneliness when and if people don't feel like they have access to the health care they need.
Well, I think access is an issue, but I also believe that funding and really prioritizing community-based services, mental health supports, peer support services is really critical because I do think we have an issue both at the federal and state level around the perpetuation of certain healthcare disparities in our communities. And when you mention healthcare, the mind and the body and the spirit are not three separate entities. They are, you know, when someone comes through our doors, when we meet someone in the community, provide those services, we're treating the whole person. And I think we have to remember that. So I think the access is absolutely an issue, but also stigma, and I would even say discrimination, is, I think, a major obstacle as well to, you know, accessing services, because people, it's not the first thing people, there is that shame, there is that stigma that exists, which impacts, you know, access in many ways.
George, I think it's so interesting. I want to double back to what you said earlier, which, you know, that we're sort of, it's a chicken and egg kind of thing here in some ways. Isolation and loneliness can lead to really bad health outcomes, or if you're unhealthy for whatever reason, if you're feeling like you need health care and you're not getting it, that can lead to isolation and loneliness. But this question of health being something that then leads, like having bad health is a risk factor for depression, for isolation, for all of these things that we think of as maybe separate from your own health is so interesting and something that you're saying you see a lot in the people that you interact with, that this idea of not having healthcare or not being healthy can actually lead you to isolation and loneliness.
Right. And I do think it really does go both ways. What's interesting, and I although I don't have the reference right now, but I know a couple of years ago there was a study that, and I believe it was the Vermont Psychiatric Survivors put together a study to look at why people go to the emergency room. And one of the top two reasons for people going to the emergency rooms in our hospitals was loneliness. And that seems so simple, and that seems so it seems, you know, some might think, well, that's a little odd. And yet we know that social isolation and loneliness are there are factors that are called social determinants of health, the factors that contribute to health. And loneliness is clearly one of those social contributors to ill health, to having challenges with health. And I know in some countries, I know, I think it's the United Kingdom, they've actually developed a whole ministry, a minister of loneliness. I mean, they see the issues there. So I think we're not alone in Vermont. But it's certainly a challenge. And I think access is really key. But I think the other piece is really looking at community connections, looking at developing those relationships in the community, developing programs and supports, but also the formal, informal or natural supports that really can create those connections.
That's George Karabakakis, the CEO at Healthcare and Rehabilitation Services of Southeastern Vermont. George, I really appreciate your perspective and bringing that full circle for us. Thank you.
Thank you.
Dan Smith, I saw you scribbling notes. What were you thinking?
I mean, I come back to the idea that the opposite of isolation is a sense of connection. And, you know, I think by and large, we do as a set of communities in Vermont feel very deeply connected to each other. And we own that as an ethos. And I think the platform of philanthropy reflected at the VCF is reflective of neighbors' commitment to helping neighbors. But I think we also have to be really honest with ourselves that connection gets harder and harder when the lived experience of so many Vermonters is so very different from our own, whether it's around education, the civic structure and environment and how we're engaging, whether it's around whether we share a common experience when we walk down our street or down a dirt road. And we need to be open to the fact that we have neighbors who are living lives that are very, very different than we may be.
Susan, I want to give you a chance for a final thought as well. I mean, certainly not solving the loneliness problem here today on the show, but what do you think? You know, what do we do about this?
If I had a magic wand, I guess what I would do would be to say whatever we can do to have people feel needed, whether it's an elderly person reading a storybook at a story hour at the local library, or whether it's somebody being able to give somebody a ride, or somebody getting out of jail and needing a ride to an AA meeting. Like, whatever it is that you can do to make yourself available across class divides in rural areas, whether it's in Bennington or St. Albans or Barrie or the Valley, wherever it is, just opening yourself up to it. I think people are so maxed out that we have to make a really intentional, deliberate effort to put our stupid machines down, get our faces out of our phones, and make eye contact and tell people that they matter.
It's so interesting because one of the questions in the poll is, do you have people to rely on? And, you know, very, very few people had a lot of people to rely on. But I think a lot of people want to be relied on. And so that question of how to connect the people who need someone with the people who need to be needed is a really interesting one. That's Susan Randall, an investigator at VT Private Eye in Burlington. She works with a wide range of attorneys on civil, state, and federal cases. Dan Smith is the president and CEO of the Vermont Community Foundation. The Community Foundation is one of the sponsors of this project, and we also have support for the project from AARP Vermont. Dan and Susan, thank you so much for sharing your perspective today.
Thank you, Jane.
Thank you for having us.